Welcome back, my friends, to the show that never ends. Ladies and gentlemen, KSCO presents the Dr. Future Show. If you would like to join in our show today, you can call us at 831-479-1080. That's 831-479-1080. And now, your host, Dr. Future.
Hey, folks, welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. Yes, star in a jar that could lead to limitless energy for us all. Isn't that exciting? Well, this hour, we're pleased to have Dr. Bruce Damer in the studio and his lovely wife, Galen, who may or may not say something at the right time. I'm sure she will.
I hope so.
Yeah, we hope so. Well, I think last time we talked to Bruce on the air was when you were doing an asteroid capture project.
Right, I think so, yeah.
Yeah, and that was outer space.
That was outer space, yeah.
And basically the idea was to, wouldn't you say, to put an asteroid in a bag and bring it into lunar orbit?
Yeah, and then extract the resources to build floating gas stations for Elon to take his people to Mars.
And then we'd have interplanetary gas stations.
Yep, we could create sustainable spaceflight all across the solar system. Yep. Mm.
Yeah. Boy, it suggests to me that we're going to have to like hitchhike to get fuel while we're trying to get to Mars. You know, we're going to have to like catch a comet.
Yeah, the next alien that comes into orbit will have a giant thumb, not a Facebook like, but a itch thumb that's floating there.
Going my way.
Pick us up, going my way.
Mars or bust.
Exactly, yeah.
Saturn by Sunday.
What I wonder is, can comets become autonomous? Autonomous
can comets
vehicles?
Become... Well, that one that seemed to eat the filet lander, right?
Yeah.
Oh, yes. We've been saving that little article just for you. We have one in our slate.
Can you tell the audience what that's all about? What's happened?
Well, the Europeans sent this ambitious mission to rendezvous with a comet that was approaching the sun, and they actually got a lander down on it. It didn't grapple the surface, and it bounced.
Does everybody remember this was in 2014?
Yeah. They found it in a little sort of crevice in the shadow, which of course killed its power generation. So it was like the ideal,
the worst place to land. Yeah.
They see it.
Yeah.
It was kind of excitement a couple of days ago.
So the lander is called Philae?
Philae, yeah.
Yeah, Philae really needed a star in a jar.
Yeah, they had a star in a jar.
Solar power did not work.
And that solar power, see, that's the big argument, is that should we really put our resources in something as crazy as fusion, or should we really invest in something we know works, like solar, make it better?
Yeah, just a lot of solar collection.
A lot of sun is just hitting the planet all the time. Why don't we use it? You know,
we should definitely use it first, because it's accessible. Let's talk about low-hanging fruit, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's going to come down to costs. I mean, in what is it, 5 or 10 years, the cost of solar watts are going to be lower than burning coal, for sure. Mm-hmm. It's going to cross over.
Yeah, so it kind of makes a lot of sense to go solar, and we're getting a lot of free solar. So what are we thinking trying to create a star in a jar? What's the, you know, why are we?
Well, that's going to be way more expensive than either.
It's attractive to big utilities because they can centralize generation, right?
So utilities will invest portable, in that. Yeah, the tunnel.
But we will have a very expensive toll for people to use our power.
Power like you guys do.
What's our thinking? We're living off the grid. It has influenced our thinking.
Totally. So central power generation is sort of anathema to you guys because you do it yourself.
Well, I believe in centralized power generation at the level of a neighborhood. Mm. You know, I don't think everybody should have to bother with every technical detail of how the power flows through your house. I think it would drive people crazy if everybody tried to do their own solar panels.
But wouldn't you say part of Musk's dream is that everyone is generating enough power to actually feed energy into the grid?
So yeah, and to their transportation costs to charge their vehicles and charge their drones that go and do the shopping. And
I like it. Talk about job replacement. Like, let's have solar panel job replacement. So our solar panels earn the income. Mm. And then, you know, all of the power that we don't use is available as free money coming in.
Yep. Of course, there'll be a glut on the market then.
Yeah, let's hear it for solar gluts. Solar gluts would be the best thing for global warming.
Yeah, well, it does. It, and And certainly, well, just to create the strangest segue you've ever heard, don't you think lots of free energy was essential for all of this to begin in the first place, for life as we know it, to have energy?
In fact, life learned how to harness free energy and kick off heat. So it didn't violate a little thing called the second law of thermodynamics. So life is a surfer on the random movement of water molecules.
Was life a solar surfer, or what was life surfing?
It was surfing heat. So everything comes in and heats up the water. Water molecules bounce around, and they push the molecules like enzymes around, which fold and do jobs, and then they have to be reset. And then they unfold, and then they do the next job the next time, and a little bit of heat's made, and that's how we run. Uh-huh. We're surfing chaos. You know, Ralph Abraham's energy source.
Yeah, we just had on just before our vacation. The father of chaos theory.
You know, folks, Bruce is talking about the origin of life, which he studies deeply. And he's brought some amazing specimens here to the show today. And we're going to be getting a nice little immersion into our original ancestors, who basically ruled the planet for the first 3 billion years or so, right?
They were king of the hill, king of everything else. Yeah.
Yeah. And I'd like to get a little bit into you that really, you know, since we're getting into the origin of life itself, what it was like just before there was life. It's in the transition.
Save some for later.
Hot.
Okay,
good. Lava oceans, folks.
Lava.
Lava oceans.
Like in Maui? I mean, not in Maui. It's a big island.
The whole planet.
Really? Yeah. So life was swimming in hot lava, and it was everywhere on the planet?
It was life then. It was all just huge tides of molten crust moving up and down up to a mile high after the Earth and the Moon formed. Because the moon was pulling tides, but it was rock tides. And this is where we had oceans. So that's the Hadean period.
How long ago would that
4.57 to 4.2 billion years ago.
5.7 to...
Because that was the date of the moon forming 4.2. event, which is a collision with Earth. It made the moon.
So it wasn't out of the Earth? The moon didn't come out of the Earth?
It did from an impactor. Yeah.
It sounds to me like it slid through a molten ocean. And
it was like a huge blow.
And the Earth got whacked and
it got whacked, and then it got a spray of stuff that came off and formed into the moon.
All right. This blast from the past is part of the Dr. Future show. We're going to go to a break.
About life origins here. We'll be back. Dr. Bruce Damon. Welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. We're talking with Dr. Bruce Damer in the studios, who actually just got back from an Origin of Life research trip in Australia. We'd like to bring that into focus in relation to the origin of life itself. We were beginning to describe what happened to the Earth at the period of time when life first began. And you were saying it had to do with when the moon was born, so to speak, 4.5 billion years ago, and then because it was born because we got whacked by some large object. How big an object would...
That was the size of Mars, they estimate.
Really?
Pool
balls, almost.
Yeah, and it actually tilted our axis, because it almost destroyed Earth, and it flipped the axis over a little bit. That's why we have a tilted axis, and then all this crud was in the orbit, and it accreted into the moon in about a month.
Really?
Yeah, and then you had this huge moon that was like glowing orange, and it was only 15,000 miles out, and it was so close.
15,000 miles?
15,000 miles.
Before geosynchronous?
Yeah, before through tidal forces and friction, it moved out to where it is now at 250,000 miles. But during those years, it was pulling the lava oceans up by about a mile. It was a bulge that went around, you know, like 6-7 hour orbit.
Wow.
So it was unpleasant. These were unpleasant times. And so it took until about, as far as we know, there were actual liquid oceans at 4.2 billion years.
Wow. Which Can I just give a metaphor of what that made me think of? Is the ocean of lava being drawn by the moon. If you've ever taken an egg that hasn't been boiled an unboiled egg and you try and spin it, it has this really irregular orbit, right?
So it does.
Yeah, yeah. So I imagine the planet was kind of like that. It was like an egg that had all this stuff sloshing irregularly around.
it was an egg without a shell even.
Right. Just a gravity shell.
Oh, geez. Well, how were we able to figure all this out, Bruce? How do we know these things?
Little preserved bubbles in zircons have stuff in them that could only have been made with liquid water, and those are over 4 billion years old. So there was no crust preserved from those days. It's like there's nothing left in the fossil record until about 3.7 billion years ago. So it's a big unknown, and if life started back in that so-called late Hadean period, on volcanic islands, like steaming volcanic islands, we don't have a record of it.
Now, the other ingredients for this, for life, would be the heat. Now, you're talking water. So how did the water get to the planet?
That's interesting. They used to think a lot of it was delivered by comets coming in.
Yeah, I've heard of those theories. Yeah.
But now they believe most of it came from the cooling of the mantle rock itself and just released a lot of water.
There was water in it in the rock?
H2O, huh?
It's H2O coming out of that solidifying rock.
Yeah, I mean, it's hot enough to be able to get water out of rock?
Steam.
Yeah,
steam. As it cooled.
Exactly. So if you're in Hawaii and you see all those lavas that are coming out, actually put out a lot of vapor, you know, so the rock actually has water locked up in it.
The Vog, yeah.
Yeah, it has water locked up in it. So we get this huge ocean. So Venus could have had a huge ocean that boiled off. It boiled off from being too close to the sun, and it went into a runaway greenhouse.
With Venus.
With Venus. And Mars had an ocean, but it was shallower, and Mars couldn't hold its ocean. It just wasn't big enough, didn't have a magnetic field.
So that experiment didn't quite work.
It had oceans for a while, and then it dried out. So we're like in the Goldilocks zone, you know, just right. The bowl of porridge is right.
Do they have liquid water on Mars, don't they? Isn't that in the Goldilocks zone, too?
In the poles, there's frozen.
So it's just barely in the Goldilocks zone. It's on the outer fringes.
It's gotten to a place where life... If it's there, it's deep in the rocks.
Well, let's say we had the ability to move its orbit.
Move our orbits.
I say billiard balls all over.
Yeah,
anything, change everything.
They say it's billiard balls all the way down.
yeah. So as far as can guess, we think life could have started anywhere from 4.2 billion years ago to maybe 4.0. But last week in the New York Times, there was an article about Greenland rocks at 3.7, which show evidence of stromatolites, these layered things.
All right, so tell us about stromatolites. They would be the first form of life on planet Earth?
Well, I'm holding one right in my hand for our radio listener audience.
It looks like a rock, but it has, articulations in it. Folds, crusty-looking circular patterns of what look to be like rock.
It looks like igneous rock in that it is kind of lava-like, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's kind of red, but it definitely looks like it's burnt. And it also looks like fossilized mud.
Yeah, Dr. and Mrs. Future, very, very clear and cogent comments. What you're holding in your hand is... basically a layers of preserved shoreline of a hot spring.
Ooh.
So what you're seeing in those layers, it's called a rock texture.
Passing it to Mrs. Future.
Is where if you go, this is for our listener audience, if you go to a lake shore or kind of a muddy marsh area or the side of a pool in a hot spring or even the ocean, you kind of get this environment where there's like kind of a slime growing on the surface.
Slime.
Sort of bubbles off oxygen. That's actually what this is. It's those sort of slimy, slippery surfaces are like the plaque on your teeth. They're called biofilms, and they grow amongst grains. And then when more grains are placed on top of them, they can't get at sunlight, which they need to feed their whole community. So they grow up through the grains, and they cement the grains underneath them into a kind of cement.
Oh, so it looks kind of like sandstone, but it's got this beautiful lacy layer texture where it's scalloped. It's got lots and lots of ridges
beautifully described. Beautifully described.
Is this where the creature would be, where it's ridged like that?
What you're seeing is a dome where there were trillions of individual little bacterium.
Trillions
and trillions of individuals all working in what's called a consortia. model where they all work together. So the top layer are your blue-green cyanobacteria that collect sunlight. And then a layer down, there's the things that eat the products of the sunlight. Hmm. And then further down, there's other ones that eat the things that,
really,
die
so you
off.
Need a team in order
like
to live.
Plants and worms.
You don't need a team in order to live then.
It's yeah, not. It's a communal, colonial, cooperative system that dominated life on Earth for about 85% of the time.
Wait a minute, so the first organism wasn't a single cell?
It wasn't a single cell. It was a communal unit.
It was a communal organism.
It was a communal organism, so this is almost like a Star Trek idea.
It was a blob.
It wasn't an individual?
In our model, in the theory Dave Diemer and I put forth.
That's Dr. Diemer at UC.
UC Santa Cruz. Here in town. We've developed this. It's in two publications now. Mm-hmm. It may be soon featured in the New York Times. We're not sure about that, the timing for that. And in Scientific American, that'll be next year. But we've come up with a viable, what we believe is a plausible chemical model to show how life started from basically little soap bubbles in accumulating in these hot hydrothermal pools.
So there'd be outdoor hot springs.
We like spas so much.
Started life.
Yes.
Hot springs.
We come
the
from
origin.
Bubble baths.
And it wasn't the water; it was baths. The bubbles in the water.
The bubbles in the water that you think of like sea springs. Foam or foam
froth.
In your bathtub.
So we're from froth.
We're frothy entities.
Froth creatures.
All right, froth beings.
So these froths dry down and contain and trap amino acids and nucleic acids and what and build your
in the froth
in the froth in the interfroth.
In the froth, when you look closely, it's actually small little tightly packed bubbles.
It tightly packed bubbles, and then they flatten out and they squeeze all the things together and make long chains, long polymers, which are the polymers
of
life.
They came from bubbles squeezing together.
Bubbles squeezing together, and then when the water comes back in the bathtub, more bubbles are made, and they contain all these long chain biopolymers. And it's like a big roulette wheel turning around and around and around until you get the right bootstrap, the right code that was made by chance to start life. It's as simple as that.
So there were a lot of experiments going on, and one of them started
It was a churning ocean.
Started working. It wrote its own bootstrap code by accident, and then the bootstrap code started running inside the bubble, made the bubble really stable. It was like chill, and then the bubble survived and then made another copy of the bootstrap code. And then now there's two bubbles with the bootstrap code in it. That's it. And this is doable in the lab chemically. We can test this now.
Some perturbation in the froth.
Perturbation in the froth.
Wow. And it sounds like the beginning of DNA, too.
Yeah, something like a DNA would have been made by chance, Mrs. Future. Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
I see. So Dave Diemer, I first came across
Dave Diemer. He's a membrane expert, right.
At a NASA astrophysics conference. The conference was focusing on extremophiles, and the question was about whether the origin of life was inevitable and could happen anywhere in the universe, or whether it was unique to Earth and depended on some kind of a crisis like a heat wave to help us develop a cell wall. So it sounds like you guys have come up with some completely other way of explaining it.
Yeah, and in fact, any world that has rock at the surface and liquid water and cycling, where things dry down and you get rainfalls, you get geysers, whatever, can create this machine, this sort of Genesis engine to create, to potentially go to life. So it could be quite common. Simple life could be quite common.
Wow.
Everywhere, you know.
All right.
Goldilocks zones everywhere.
Goldilocks zones
everywhere.
Folks, or it might not be.
We're speaking with Dr. Bruce Diemer, about origins of life here on the Dr. Future Show. And we're going to cut away to our CBS News break and a few sponsors, and we'll be right back. Stay tuned.
Okay, welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. Mrs. Future and I are talking to Dr. Bruce Diemer about his research and explorations of the origin of life. Just came back from Australia, where he brought back some samples of stromatolites, the first form of life. Now, before we go much deeper into the story here, Bruce, some of the audience may be wondering why origin of life is important, or why we should care at this point in time, given that we're highly evolved species. Why should we care about these simple organisms that started it all?
Well, I think that they can teach us something really important, because if we see that this is where we came from.
Yeah.
So there's a philosophical shift. For 150 years, it's sort of been believed that the whole process was driven by competition, sort of red tooth and claw.
Survival of the fittest.
Survival of the fittest. Uh-huh. And science has sort of moved beyond that because it sees the system as a really interconnected network. But if within science, if we can show that, in fact, the whole thing, all of life, all of our ancestors started as this cooperative unit, this matrix, you know, this network.
That the first life was actually a cooperative.
It was, and that it couldn't be any other way, and that certainly competition was happening within cooperation, but cooperation is still the dominant mode today. I mean, all the soils and plants and trees that are coming up and they're feeding, we're grazers, you know, we're parasites on the microbial world, which is now called forests and plants and trees and ponds full of things.
Yeah. And so we're parasites of the trees?
Yeah,
the plants?
Yeah, we don't make our own food, right? So we have to eat the products of...
have to eat plants.
And so if the origin of life was this wonderful microbial community that created soils and created root networks and eventually plants...
Okay, well, let's look at this first one again. Now, it's basically like a simple robot in a way, right? Or some kind of community where it takes in molecules and excretes them.
Yeah, and in fact, what they had to learn to do when these little protocell bubbles got together, they had to gradually evolve all the tricks to do all this. So there was a period where it was mostly like, almost like the accumulation of a mineral, but it wasn't life yet. It was just the accumulation of sort of sludge.
This is why they call it primordial soup.
Exactly.
Salts.
It was a gel. It was a sludgy thing.
So was it eating carbon dioxide or inhaling? Did it breathe? Did it consume? Was it like an amoeba?
In the beginning, it was eating all the particles that came in from space.
Anything coming in to
its... It was eating outer space.
What are called interplanetary dust particles that would have had all the amino acids on. Various things were
dust
feeding these pools.
From space.
Yep,
so it was actually feeding on Mars.
It was feeding on the kind of the leftovers of the solar system, because the solar system was accretion disk was full of organics.
Mm-hmm.
And it still is. I mean, you can literally, if you clear your gutters in the fall, you're going to find interplanetary dust particles in there.
For the uninitiated, what's an accretion disk?
That was the kind of almost like Saturnian ring system that forms around stars with all this dust and ices and everything as a star is coming to life. And then various bigger chunks in that disk become planets. Some of them mostly gas, some of them mostly rock.
And this happens in every solar system that has planets.
Yeah, and you can actually, they've now, Kepler and other missions have seen actual solar system disks forming.
Really, they've seen this in like early phases of formation?
Yeah, with shadows being cast across the disk and little gaps in the disk.
So we can see little baby solar systems.
Yeah, baby solar systems, wow. Yeah. Huh. Yeah, it's not just Star Trek anymore. You know?
Yeah, they're out there.
They're out there.
I think we found at least 1,000 or so.
It's coming on that.
All different phases of evolution.
And we found out our solar system's really rare. It's a really rare one.
I know we're not a binary star, and most stars in this galaxy are binary.
And they don't have nice little placid circular orbits for little rocky worlds close in. And you know, a big protector called Jupiter that's keeping all the rocks away from them and keeping them in nicely cozy orbits. That's not that
keeps
common.
Us from being bombarded.
Yeah, it keeps us from getting bombarded. And often solar systems are unstable, like we talked about chaos theory. Mm. And a planet moves slightly and then it kicks out the other ones.
Like so a billiard game again.
Yeah, don't move Mars anytime soon.
I see. This is a bad idea.
It's a bad idea.
At least we have until we reach this.
We are not putting you in charge of the death charge.
Should Kaku say a stage 2 civilization?
Star.
You know, where we have mastery of a solar system level intelligence, and so moving stuff around in a solar system is part of what we
can do that with Shepard with little objects. Start.
Yeah, we got to start simple.
In fact, we'll move to stage 2 when we have thousands of space rocks orbiting the Earth-Moon system that we're mining and pulling water ice off and building biospheres out of. And then we'll be like, oh, that'll be they call the Dyson sphere, the sphere around the entire sun that collects the energy of an advanced civilization. Maybe the Damer disk is the disk of Shepard balloon captured objects around a home planet. If I can coin my own...
why not?
Damer disk.
It provides a life support for moving us into a solar system economy.
Yep, absolutely.
That makes you a shepherd.
Yeah. How do we go from planetary to solar system thinking? This is how.
I'll have the long gray beard for the shepherd thing soon. And the staff, you know. Move along, asteroids.
You're part of our world now.
That's right.
That's it. Yeah, stop bleeding.
It'll be a mesh network out there.
Yeah, that's right.
It'll be more like Battlestar Galactica. It's like, come on, Damer Disc, we're moving to Jupiter.
That's
no,
it.
No, yeah. What do,
heading to Ganymede
yeah,
to
the ragtag
pick up some
fleet,
supplies.
The ragtag fleet will be...
What about comets? Do you think they would be part of the ragtag fleet?
They're problematic because they come in from really weird orbits, but pieces of them are in the inner solar system, and we can capture those. We got lots of water ice and molecules. Yeah. Yeah, actually, every August when you see the Perseids and Leonids, that's mm-hmm. a tale of an old comet coming into the atmosphere.
Oh. And they have water, too, right?
They do. They have a lot of stuff on board.
Huh. And so they would be ripe for materials in space, then.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, when we go hunting for these, when we have prospector companies looking for valuable, doing futures contracts on these objects, they'll find these things.
Yeah, they'll find the comets.
Yeah, and they'll get a claim on it, and they'll sell the claim to a developer. But just like mining
the Wild West?
Totally. It's going to be totally like that. Mm-hmm. Nickel iron asteroids.
Serenity.
Platinum one.
They'll go around and have little robot scanning ships looking for what's where. And
yep, hopefully by mid to late century, It's just the same as we do economics here.
What do you think would speed that process up to get us more into a solar system economy?
You know, somebody like Elon Musk could. I don't think he's got all his billiard balls lined up to do this thing yet.
He needs other people.
He's got to create a sustainable fuel station system. You can't just take one crew out. It's like you couldn't sell a Tesla car if you had no charging
stations. It's not
stations.
As glamorous to think you're building gas stations in space as opposed to being the pioneer discovering Mars. And
I
don't know.
Like
you know, it used to be really glamorous during the heyday of the freeways. Yeah. Like Route 66 was like a real attraction. I mean, all kinds of people set up along the way to
be
like
that, but
a destination.
But you don't hear about the inventors of Route 66.
But Standard Oil, in the 19th century, Standard Oil created distribution system and for fuel, right? That then created gas stations all over the country that allowed Route 66 to be built. Mm-hmm. But they couldn't do anything until they had those refueling stations. Like the railroads needed coal and they needed wood supplies and water.
Does it have to happen the same way, private enterprise to create?
It can be a little of both.
Government too.
Could be.
Well,
government.
To make things happen, the rule in creative circles is you need a deadline to start a project and an extension to finish it.
Well, here's what I think will kickstart it. Either we have something coming that's going to smack us, or better still, we have a comet that gets caught by accident in the Earth-Moon system and is rotating around the Earth, and so many people realize, oh, this is economically very valuable. We have 250,000 tons of water ice on here.
Mm-hmm.
They start making
claims, and people try to going to grab the thing, which is how we came up with the Shepard idea in the first place, was an accidental capture of, because the comet will be in orbit, you'll see it every night, and have a tail shooting off and be pretty bright, and then once that tail stops going, there's no more volatiles left, and it doesn't worth as much.
I think it's a new kind of cowboy, the comet cowboy. It's like go up there and wrangle the comets in, right?
Yeah. Who wants to be a comet cowboy? That does sound like could be a fun story.
Cometic water will sell for Earth for like $10,000 a liter, and
I'm
people
sure
drink
it. Has incredibly
fancy
helpful
people will drink
properties.
Comet water, whole business.
Yeah. Now, what about the current lay of the land, though? We do have companies that are thinking like this, don't we? In Silicon Valley, they have the asteroid mining company.
We do, but they're not realistic. I mean, they don't know anything about asteroids.
This is far more realistic.
What's their name? Planetary Resources?
On their websites, they show cables wrapped around these things and buildings planted there, and that's nonsense.
And, of course, Philae, the first attempt to, like, land on a comet, and what happened? It was
it's a hole-in-one going into a tricky environment. Tricky environment.
But they're looking for platinum and stuff like that. Didn't that make sense in terms
of
being...
Well, that was one of the things thrown in the air, but there's no economic justification for that either.
Really?
Yeah, because the cost of actually getting metals out of these environments and returning them to the Earth is so high. And we already know where all the platinum is. It's all in landfills. We just need to mine it out of landfills.
So it's cheaper to get it and out of mine landfills than it is to go into the asteroid belt.
You're just talking economics.
Yeah, economics.
But what about the glory?
Well,
it's not just dollars that make things happen.
Being a platinum miner probably gets you laid, though. You know, it's serious.
Who could platinum miners? Yeah, we'll move off of platinum.
Yeah, okay. All right, it's true. We're going to a new world where what we used to be considered valuable other things are more so these days. We'll get into that after the break.
All right, here we go. Dr. Future Show on KSEO. Stay tuned.
Okay, welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. We have a wide-ranging conversation with Dr. Bruce Damer as he has been exploring two major areas of late, asteroid capture and origin of life. And they both are leading to us creating, I'd say, a new, what I'm calling a solar system economy. We're starting to move beyond the planet in our day-to-day thinking about what is real.
Yeah, talk about the Renaissance.
During the famous Renaissance,
that was pretty much after the New World was discovered. People thought they were looking for China, so they started sending boats out into the ocean, and instead of falling off the flat Earth, they didn't find China. They found a whole new world.
Yeah, Mars is the new India.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And if human civilization wants to keep growing and using more energy and making more phones and keep going and going and going, we will have to expand our resource base and our living space.
We were talking recently about the idea of there being this beautiful time on Earth where we're really in the Goldilocks zone, where we're not in the Venus scenario where we've got too much heat drying up all the oceans. How long do you think the Goldilocks zone for Earth is? Well, when do we have to be off the planet?
Do we have a time limit?
Interesting. James Lovelock, in his new book, and he's the discoverer of the ozone
hole. The Gaia hypothesis.
Yeah.
The idea that the Earth was possibly a living organism itself. Huh?
Yeah, that it's like a self-managing sort of
system.
Yeah. And his new book, there's a chilling chapter which describes that this Terminator, which gobbled up Venus billions of years ago, made it too hot for liquid oceans, is approaching Earth. And the first phase of that is 100 million years or so, according to his calculations, where the atmosphere can have zero CO2, none. Hmm. Otherwise, we go to runaway greenhouse.
So it doesn't matter if we pollute the atmosphere with CO2?
We might accelerate that a little bit.
Speed it
so
up.
So wait, we have 100 million years, and during that time, we have to get all the CO2 out of the atmosphere and sequestered into rocks at the bottom of the ocean.
The sun's on a heat curve, so it's going to go up by 4 or 5%.
The sun is going to get hotter, delivering more energy to the land.
So that behooves us then to have a solar system mentality by that time. I mean, to really get out of the way.
Because in fact, the vitality, in a sense, Earth has bald spots everywhere now. It's got all these deserts and glaciation periods, and the vitality of the biosphere is reduced. It's in middle to late middle age.
Really? We're starting to get to be a little past our prime here on this planet?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you have to go back 200 million years to find the peak time of plants, for example, when
there was
the most
plants. That would be a prime for
them.
But wouldn't this be prime for our species now, though? I mean, we've never had 7 billion creatures as smart as our little...
It is, but the overall biosphere doesn't have the vitality that it used to
have. It can't support us much longer on this level, you're saying?
Well, it possibly could. We're inventing new biospheres. We'll do hydroponics and we'll do...
That's true.
We'll grow more food. We're transforming the Anthropocene.
We could solve aging and then help the planet out.
Okay, so the goal here is to become an M-class planet, right? What is the...
Well, we are an M-class planet.
Type 2 civilization.
We want to be able to take life as we know it. A type 0.
So sustainable that we could be existing anywhere and continuing to imagine
new days and new horizons.
We're not fighting each other. We're just building beautiful new living structures everywhere and expanding our horizons and looking at our psychology, our spirituality, and our health, and extending our lives. And you know,
all right, so I'm going to put out there, since it takes a deadline to start a project and an extension to finish it. Okay, folks, we've got about 100 million years, okay?
That's it.
That's our window. We're in the Goldilocks zone. That's not enough time to get to another planet that's light years away. You know, that's like, you got to bring it with you and leave no trace.
I guess this is our paradise.
This will be written in the cosmic book, Our First Million Years. Our first million.
Our first million. Yeah.
Hey, we've got a caller. You want to talk to Colonel Terry? He has some news about Lovelock.
Colonel Terry.
First of all, smart lady, the name of your guest, he's wonderful. It is again who and
Dr.
where is
Bruce
he from?
Dr. Bruce Damer. He is a local.
D-E-I? How do you spell
it? D-A-M-E-R. Dr. Damer. You can go to damer.com.
Okay. First of all, let me compliment him on his erudition. I spent time at the White House Science Office.
During the Clinton administration, right?
Yeah, that's right. And we looked at forward threats, et cetera. Yeah. And Clinton was fully informed, but would not address the environmental degradation that we are inflicting on this continent and the planet. Because people wouldn't lack him if he told them the truth. Mm-hmm. His words.
Wouldn't lack him.
Okay. That's right.
Now, but why did he want people to lack him?
Yes, he's from...
Well, he wanted them to. I didn't.
Yes, he was a personable fellow.
Right. Dr. Damer, you're familiar with James Lovelock, I'm sure, and his Gaia theory?
He's quoting him
just
a little while ago.
Yeah, we just quoted his new book.
Oh, I just missed that. All right. We're going off the cliff and et cetera. Does he see a chance for us to recover the planet, which I do not? Does he see us a chance for going to Mars and if you will, hosting continuity of our species there? Where does he see the trend taking us?
You know, I think everything that is happening now is just going to be happening more in the future. So there will be an intensification of all aspects rather than a real shift, I think. So everything's just blooming out at the same rate or increasing rates.
How about
this? Could fusion power save us?
Confusion?
No.
You think confusion and chaos is our way out?
No, that's the chaos theory, I believe. Anyway,
yeah,
confusion.
Confusion. So I think there will be glorious things and the growth of, what did Einstein say? He thought that he didn't know which was bigger, the size of human stupidity or the size of the universe or something. So they're expanding quickly, you know, both of them. Yeah, I don't know. I'm pretty optimistic about the future because there's been so many good developments in the last 25 years. It just takes your breath away. Yeah, everywhere.
What are those?
Oh, man.
Give me two of them.
We put down 30,000 nuclear warheads that were primed and ready to go. That was a huge deal.
Talk about global warming, man. If those things went off.
And we developed universal connectivity of all human beings on these smartphones, and people can get information just everywhere. It's just all the cultures are all linked. It's amazing.
Yeah.
And the economy is all linked. Incredible stuff. You know, I go from...
But we are still poisoning the planet.
But, you know, we're doing it at a...
consciously.
We're more consciously poisoning.
Maybe it's at a decreasing rate.
Yeah, I mean, the rivers where I used to go in Eastern Europe, they're all cleaned up. You know, they were incredibly toxic when I lived in Czechoslovakia in the early 90s.
Yeah, and I remember even in Philadelphia, the Schuylkill River used to catch on fire.
And now?
Okay. And are you teaching somewhere, Dr. Damer?
I have a lot of stuff online on my Levity Zone podcast.
He's more of a researcher.
LevityZone.org. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Well,
he's still researching.
Are you in Santa Cruz so I can buy you and Mrs. Future lunch?
I live a stone's throw literally underneath them, so if they throw anything out of their house, it lands on me.
Good.
Yeah.
We'll include Dr. Future.
Robotic arms.
My next generation drone will be able to visit him.
That's right. We can take a mocha over to you.
Yeah. You can take a mocha.
Well, all right. Lastly, gentlemen, I'm sure you both agree with me. We must save the future. For Mrs. Future.
Oh, we must. Yes. Thank you. I'm so glad to have you on our team, Colonel Terry. We're all doing the best we can.
Yeah, all right. Well, take good care of yourself, beautiful. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye-bye.
Thanks for calling. That's Colonel Terry, yes. He's genuinely concerned about the future of our species. A lot of people are. They're a little worried. They hear all these headlines and about what's wrong with us all the time.
Yeah, we're hearing too much bad news. There's a lot of good news going. Because the bad news puts you in a bad state of mind, which then... begets more bad news. We just don't need that.
With despair, we go nowhere. With imagination, we make up new stuff and get along.
And at the same time...
Imagination for the nation.
Dr. Confusion say, I would taught in journalism school that when it bleeds, it leads.
Ah, yeah. You know? Hence the truth. Don't watch too much news, guys, or read too much online.
Well, just realize that if it bleeds, it leads, and that is just a little sliver in the foot of humanity. It's annoying. It's irritating. We have to do something about it, but it isn't the only thing going on. There's a lot of other opportunities. Hey, look who just stepped up to the mic.
We have Galen Branton here, Bruce's wife, and...
Hello,
welcome to the show.
Hi, Kim. Well, in that spirit of life and future and present and past and now and what's really important, cooperation, not competition, peace, not war and strife, and above all, love, here's what occurs to me. Fly me to the moon. And let me live among those stars. Let me see what life is like on Jupiter and Mars. In other words, hold my hand. In other words, darling, kiss me.
Wow.
Right on. I'm buying you a ticket on our spaceship for sure. All you guys.
Wonderful, Galen. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Galen.
A new segment on here on Dr. Future.
That's right.
Romance. Get any other inspirations.
Musical commentary.
Join the fray here.
More welcome.
So tell us a little bit more about your trip, Bruce. You were down in Australia.
Oh, way out in far northwestern Australia with geologists and literally breaking open rocks that are 3.5 billion years old.
What was the mission here? What were you trying to accomplish?
To really understand deeply the rocks talk to you on what life would have been like that far back and before. Because the life we find in Australia is pretty advanced because it's single cells, microbes, and it does all this cool stuff. Hmm. But the life before it, what we call the Progenian period, is a big mystery. And I'm doing mental models and imaginative experiments
just to see what it was actually like at that period.
To work it out in my head, the whole, say, 300-400 million years before.
Oh, fascinating. Yeah. Well, more soon on that, Bruce. Thanks for bringing us up to date by bringing
me back.
Excellent. Thanks so much, folks, for joining us. Thank you, Galen.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Mrs. Future.
Always a pleasure.
And so hope you enjoy your week, folks, and we look forward to seeing you again next week.
And this is the Dr. Future Show on KSEO.
Fly me to the moon. Let me play among the stars. Let me see what spring is like on Jupiter and Mars. In other words, hold my hand. In other words, baby, kiss me.